it's nice to meet you, so to speak.
Likewise, electronically.
Yes. I have to tell you that I think your book is one of the most important books I've read for a long time. And I've read several wonderful reviews of it, but I don't actually think they do it justice. So
very kind.
I'm looking forward to this conversation. I have way too many notes. The luxury we have is that this is not a live interview. We get to have a real conversation, and I don't really have a map. I have a lot of questions I want to ask you, mm-hmm. in part tracing the story you tell in the book, and in part talking about some of the implications that you draw and some of the, mm-hmm. you know, some of the larger lessons and meaning that you found in this project. So mm-hmm. Let me ask my producer, are we okay? Are we sounding all right? He needs to hear you. So tell me something mundane. You were just describing...
Like how I got here, which is often the question asked. Very straightforward. I took a subway F line from Brooklyn to 23rd Street.
Okay.
And just walked through this very biting cold.
Yeah. How long have you been in New York now?
And from September onwards, I sort of went away for a month, but I'm actually spending 9 months at the New York Public Library as a fellow, one of their fellows there.
Right.
So
I think that's a wonderful program.
It is a very nice, very nice program, actually. Okay. Yeah, it's the best way to spend time here mm-hmm. in New York, I think. For me, at least, it's worked out wonderfully well.
Okay, well, I think we can begin.
Excellent.
Do you know about my program at all? Do you want me to give you?
Yes, I did. I did look it up on the internet.
Okay.
It seems sort of just remarkably substantive, wide ranging. I like the Reinhold Niebuhr. Is that how you pronounce
yes,
it?
Yes, Reinhold Niebuhr. Mm-hmm.
Yes. So I was I read him a great deal while doing this Buddha project.
Did you?
Really? Yeah. Well, I sort of, one of the many people I read, but mm-hmm. also someone I came to have a special admiration for.
Well, I was thinking about him as I was reading your book, because you make observations about history in the largest possible sense, and that was such an important concern of his. So mm-hmm. that doesn't surprise me. Mm-hmm. I'll start out by saying that I think I know something about Buddhism. I've interviewed a number of Buddhists. I've interviewed Thich Nhat Hanh, but... as I began to read your account, I realized, I was surprised at how much of it astonished me and how much of it I didn't know. And I guess I was only saved from feeling quite ignorant by that, but in the fact that you also were surprised at what you discovered along the way. So I would actually like to begin, though, with something that you only allude to, and it's not really a central part of your book, but I would like to hear just a little bit more about the sort of Hindu sensibility and culture in which you grew up, and how much that part of your identity you think affected your desire to explore the legacy of the Buddha. Can you just say something about that?
Sure. Well, I grew up in what would be nominally a Hindu, called a Hindu family.
Mm-hmm.
Because Hinduism is such a flexible religion, if it is a religion at all, I mean, it's more a way of life, and it includes all kinds of faiths and beliefs and practices.
Right.
And so we certainly, and I mean me and my siblings, we never actually were under any pressure to conform to any set of ritual or any god, particular god that we wanted to worship or anything. I mean, my parents worshipped a whole range of, or admired a whole range of gods and divinities. So... I think if anything, there was anything I sort of particularly picked up from this upbringing of mine, it was a larger acceptance of, just all kinds of things and not a particular allegiance to any one mm-hmm. tradition or some sort of monolithic faith, which perhaps helped me, in my curiosity, in my interest in all kinds of, I could go into these areas without thinking that I have to be loyal to a particular set of ideas
right.
and I have to compare those sets of ideas to what I'm encountering in these other religions. So I could go into, for instance, Buddhism with, I suppose, slightly clearer mind and a slightly, blanker slate than people coming from, more monolithic traditions
right.
like Christianity or Islam. So that way it was, I suppose, helpful to belong to this particular, to be part of this particular tradition. But at the same time, as I say in the book, Buddhism as a living tradition had died out in India many centuries before. And the Buddha had become a Hindu god, at least he was considered as such. And even today, I think if you were to ask Hindus in India, most people in India would say that the Buddha was a Hindu god, was an incarnation of Vishnu, just as Krishna and Rama are incarnations of Vishnu. So I, for a very long time, believed this. And I was, of course, surprised to know that actually the Buddha may have been a historical figure and that there was, quite a lot of evidence to indicate that he was one. And furthermore, he was very different from various other, gods in the Hindu tradition in the sense that he never claimed to be God himself and certainly claimed no divine attributes or didn't offer a theology and so on. So all of that really, came as a surprise to me. But then, this discovery sort of happened over several years, and it also involved a whole lot of other things.
Right. And did you come to a conclusion about why it was that Buddhism really essentially disappeared in India for many generations, for centuries?
Well, there are all kinds of theories trying to explain this, including that the Muslims who invaded India from the sort of 9th, 10th century onwards, they destroyed a lot of monasteries up in North India and in Eastern India. But a lot of scholars would assert that Buddhism was already in decline by the time these sort of Muslims from Turkey and Central Asia and Persia came into India. And it had been in decline because Buddhism really did not sort of, create a priestly class such as one that could sort of, serve as a mediator between sort of ordinary people and, I suppose, the gods. It did not offer, a whole set of ceremonies and rituals which people could adopt in their day-to-day life in the way Brahmanism or other aspects of other Hindu traditions did.
Mm-hmm.
And it's because of its suspicion of power, of worldly power, Buddhism really couldn't become very close, or Buddhists couldn't become very close to, the sort of various kings and various emperors that ruled over India over various centuries. So it didn't quite enjoy the kind of royal patronage that people from other religious traditions could enjoy, just because, there was enough there in the traditions to sort of bring them deeper into the world as opposed to being slightly on the margins of it.
And you tell this fascinating story of how Buddhism really, in the 19th century, I've got a bad voice this week, was sort of rediscovered and uncovered, and not by Indians, but often by British colonizers, by explorers and amateur archaeologists.
It is a fascinating story. I mean, it was a remarkable achievement in the sense of, just creating this whole, forming this whole tradition, which had kind of more or less disappeared, certainly from India. I mean, people in China and Japan and a lot of other places were aware.
Yes.
And of course, Tibet and in Nepal, they were aware of the Buddha and had been sort of, following a form of Buddhism for many centuries. But India had become largely unaware of this great man who was born, of course, in North India and spent all of his life there. And the West really had very little clue about this personality until, the late 18th and early 19th century. So it was a great discovery in many ways. One of the great discoveries of the 19th century, I think. And we're kind of still, seeing it being played out in terms of Buddhism's growing popularity in the West, its transmission to the West, its sort of taking root in places like America and Europe.
And I want to really get into what the Buddha was about and how those ideas are important. But one thing you do in the book is you flesh out the Buddha as an historical figure, as a human being in the world. And one question I had, and I don't think you answered this, is to me, once I got to know the Buddha in that largest possible context in which you present him, this image that is everywhere of this sort of sitting, this fat Buddha with the belly, you know, seemed completely inadequate to me as the kind of common representation we have. Do you know where that came from? And I mean, how do you?
I think it belongs to the Southeast Asian, East Asian traditions of Buddhism. This particular image or representation of the Buddha, I've never seen that within the Indian tradition. And you know, there was also this Indo-Greek tradition of representing the Buddha very early. I think one of the earliest traditions of envisaging the Buddha, which made the Buddha look more like a European or a sort of Greek person. Mm. So there are, I mean, all these different traditions have their own versions of what the Buddha might have looked like. And I think, you know, the further the tradition travels from its place of birth, the more, you know, distant the legend is or the myth is, and the more sort of various and surprising forms it takes.
Yeah. All right. So you really did as part of your journey. You went back and retraced kind of the story of the Buddha's life and the Buddha's renunciation, that legend, and some of the real history that seems to be there. What surprised you as you started to look at this person, this character, in his time originally?
What really surprised me, because I mean, like a lot of people, and of course, in the way of the Buddha is represented now, it's very easy to detach him from his real historical context.
Yeah.
But of course, I mean, it seems very obvious to say this, but everyone, whatever, wherever they are, in whatever time in history, whatever they are saying, really, it really all comes out of a particular experience of the world. Comes out of, you know, the sort of events around them, the way in which they respond to those events. And I think the Buddha, in what he was saying, in what he was thinking about, was very much responding to what was happening around him. And of course, he was responding to, you know, kind of tumultuous changes that were very unique, you know, in India at that particular moment. And I really began to understand the nature of those changes or what they really meant, both socially and culturally.
Say some more about that.
Yeah, when I sort of began reading Nietzsche, and Nietzsche I'd been reading for much longer before, you know, much before I'd actually started reading in Buddhism.
Right.
And I kept encountering in Nietzsche various references to the Buddha and to Buddhism. Almost every book of his has several references to Buddha and the Buddhism. And Nietzsche has this very original idea about, you know, where the Buddha was coming from. And he greatly admired the Buddha, which was, you know, which was quite extraordinary because he really didn't admire anyone else.
Yeah.
And he kind of kept saying, look, the Buddha was in a sort of historical situation that I find myself in, which is that I'm seeing the end of something and the beginning of something quite extraordinary. And by that he meant that the old sort of world of Europe in which people had lived in these very small tradition-bound societies and had kind of, you know, their lives had been governed by the sort of Christian religion and by the representatives of those Christian religions, the churches and various other authorities, like, you know, the sort of the particular small political forms that they followed. Everything really was in those worlds quite sort of self-contained, and the search for meaning, a search for meaning to life, was very much satisfied by, you know, the kind of answers that were given to you,
right,
by the church, by, you know, the political authority around you. And that, of course, began to change once, you know, modernity arrived. And by modernity, Nietzsche, of course, meant the sort of great scientific political revolutions of his time, the French Revolution, the Industrial Revolution. And suddenly, you know, man or human beings discovered this enormous power that they had. And suddenly, they felt that they really could not believe in the same old gods anymore. And, you know, the secularization of Europe happens around that time,
right,
when people discover science and people discover the laws of nature. And there is, with the breakup of these older societies and the creation of these new, very, very large worlds, new states come into being. And at the same time, they begin, you know, there's now the sort of great wars begin to happen, great revolutions, extremely violent revolutions. And Nietzsche is observing all this and saying, you know, there's something terrible is now going to happen because suddenly, you know, everything is permitted and God is dead. And God, I mean, people will, of course, still keep believing in God, but their lives are now controlled by other things altogether. Their lives are controlled by very, very large impersonal forces of big business, empire, you know, completely secular institutions and ideas. And I think when he talked about the Buddha being in a somewhat similar situation, what he really meant was that the Buddha came or was born in this world where there were these sort of larger states coming into being. You know, people had been living in these small societies, which were basically sort of, you know, subsistence societies. They were dependent on agriculture for the sort of for their living. And then, of course, at some point, you know, the surplus money that they made out of agriculture that came to be invested in commerce and trade. And of course, new townships came up to accommodate these new commercial activities. And you know, people became more ambitious. There suddenly were new kinds of rulers emerging who wanted larger states, who wanted empires. Right. You know, the first empires in Indian history emerged around that time. So suddenly, once again, you have this sort of, you know, sense of people breaking out of their older worlds and people, human beings discovering their sense of power, feeling new desires within themselves. And the Buddha observed all this and observed the great, enormous violence that had been caused by this, by, you know, people sort of, you know, feeling their desires and wishing to fulfill them, even at sort of, you know, great costs of violence. And a lot of what he said and a lot of what he spoke about, especially about desire, about, you know, the sense that we have of us being autonomous individuals, you know, with certain desires to fulfill and not being connected to other people in really fundamental ways. All of that he wanted to undermine. And I think it was really Nietzsche's sense of how he was in a roughly similar position in the Europe of the 19th century compared to the Buddha in the 6th century BC. That is what really made me, you know, look at the Buddha again and to really read more about the historical context that he was born in and what kind of a world was he responding to. Also enabled me to see how the Buddha was still relevant. I mean, that is the world that we are living in, and certainly a lot of people in the so-called third world have been living in for a very long time, which has seen these extraordinary, you know, traumatic changes in the last 100-150 years, this whole experience of colonization, the experience of modernity, of development and progress, all of these ideas that, you know, we've had to kind of work our way through in these places.
And the legend that we know of the Buddha, I think if people know anything of the story of the Buddha, it is, you know, almost this kind of fairy tale quality. He was a prince and had everything, ventured out and saw that there was suffering in the world and renounced the life that he had led, the life of privilege. I mean, the way when you go back in and tell the story, I mean, there's some truth to that, although really he was part of a kind of clan, as you say, structures, social structures that in his lifetime were disintegrating, right? I mean, wasn't... Mm-hmm. I mean, how would you tell the story of the Buddha's renunciation, that beginning? Would you tell it differently than what you hear passed down in sort of popular culture?
I think that, like all sort of myths, you know, this myth also expresses a larger truth. And of course, it's superficially, it seems very, very, very kind of simple. You know, the man goes out on a chariot and sees all these different sights, and he sort of suddenly arrives at a realization that, you know, the world is full of suffering.
Mm-hmm.
But I think, you know, nobody just goes out there and sees this stuff and, you know, suddenly starts thinking about this. Obviously, there have been other events working upon him, other sights, other things he's seen and experienced. So I don't think it's, you know, too much of a leap of an imagination to suppose that the Buddha, before he went out, even if he did go out on this chariot and, you know, saw all these people, ill people or dying people, that he would have thought about these things. I mean, he certainly seems to have led a fairly sheltered life. Mm-hmm. I think, you know, which sort of gives him this peculiar advantage because, you know, what he was actually looking at were pretty obvious sights, but he could see something new in them.
Because he wasn't inured to them. He wasn't used
exactly.
to
them. Exactly. Mm-hmm. And sort of, you know, work out, you know, just remain obsessed with this insight into suffering and, you know, really work out its implications over the next few years. So in that sense, he was, you know, particularly well placed to notice it and to work upon, you know, the implications of what he discovered.
I was a little bit surprised in your account, and this makes perfect sense, but again, it's not part of the image we have of the Buddha. That, I mean, he spent years as an ascetic and traveling and learning and until he found his way to that moment of enlightenment or that period of enlightenment. What is that noise?
Oh, I'm sorry.
Oh, that's, is that you? Okay.
I'll switch it off.
Oh, okay. All right.
Sorry about that.
I thought it was someplace in the, you know, under the fig tree in Bodh Gaya. But in some ways, he did go out and he was something of an evangelical figure. I mean, that word is so loaded in our culture. But, you know, he did then declare himself to be the enlightened one and that he was an enlightened sage. And then he went out to make converts, to find people to follow, not really follow him, but follow what he'd learned.
I think he was, you know, working in a highly competitive mm-hmm. arena. In the sense that there were so many people out there preaching all kind of stuff and talking about. I mentioned some of the sort of big countercultural figures at the time who were sort of going around and lecturing, discoursing on various things, on fate, and a lot of extremely nihilistic thinkers too. I mean, people who said there's absolutely no point in anything at all and you could just go around killing thousands and thousands of people and you would not sort of, you know, not have to deal with any consequences at all. So there was a lot of this kind of dangerous stuff around too. And I think in many of his discourses, many of his dialogues, he's constantly referring to some of these ideas and attacking them. So I think he probably was very perturbed, very sort of, you know, dismayed by this stuff that was being said by various people. And as I said, I mean, it was such a time of chaos that people could say just about anything and be believed because, you know, ordinary people were so bewildered, they were so confused, they were ready to believe. It's a bit like now, they were just ready to believe anything they were told.
Right.
And I think he felt it was important to, you know, as it were, offer something, and maybe it was important also to be a bit aggressive or show busy in offering this stuff, or to be claiming that, you know, what he was saying was indeed wisdom. Mm. And of course, looking back at him, you know, from this distance, it does seem that he was a bit, he may have been a bit brusque, or he may have tried to convert people, but not, you know, converting in the sort of in the sense we are familiar with in the monolithic religions or the monotheistic religions of the Middle East. Conversion in Buddhism really means nothing at all because, you know, you have to do the hard work within yourself.
Right.
And
it's not really joining
saying,
something. It's
exactly. I mean, what mm-hmm. are you joining? Mm-hmm. There is nothing to join. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of hard work to do, mm-hmm. but really nothing to convert to.
So the Four Noble Truths would be the basic premises. I mean, there's much more, and in fact, you go through all the many existing texts and stories about the Buddha and about his sermons and his talks. But the basic idea of suffering, you know, just again, as I read your book, it felt, and this is what you're saying, you discovered it. It felt so present. I mean, the idea of suffering as all pervasive and everyday part of a world of change and decay rings so true in the 21st century, and it even is in sync with what we know from science, right, and from mm-hmm. cutting edge psychology, and that really is the basic insight of the Buddha, right?
Absolutely. I mean, mm-hmm. I think The business of how should I live, you know, it sounds sort of just bewilderingly large, but that is the question that almost all of us are faced with every day.
Mm-hmm.
And a set of ideas, a system of wisdom, which is how I think of Buddhism, not as a religion, but as a system of wisdom, which sort of gives you these ethical ideas, these ethical notions, and which are not only to do with individual suffering or, you know, feeling discontented, but also the kind of larger suffering in the world, makes you see how it comes about, what can be done about it, how you can be responsible for it. I mean, of course, it's interesting that, you know, after fancying ourselves for so long at having arrived at the summit of, you know, prosperity and affluence, and, you know, look at all these wonderful marvels of science and technology, that we find that none of these wonderful things, none of these wonderful institutions do not really give us much ethical guidance. I mean, science is certainly not proved very capable of doing that. If anything, I mean, if, you know, science mm-hmm. has actually proved that it can be put to all kinds of extremely destructive uses, and certainly scientists have not proved to be very ethically sound people. And by that, I don't just mean, you know, A.Q. Khan of Pakistan selling nuclear technologies, but also, you know, all kinds of people here who have developed these very destructive
technologies. Science is morally neutral, as you say. I mean, it can go
absolutely.
Either way.
Absolutely. Yeah. But, you know, we've had this fate certainly in the last 200 years, and the whole sort of Western tradition of philosophy has been replaced by science. I mean, in the sense that even philosophy in its positivist mood wants to be like science. So it's no longer this sort of, you know, business of wisdom, which it was for the Greeks, even as late as Spinoza. It's being still talked about as, you know, as a system of wisdom, not, you know, as a form of theory. But we have had this sort of great faith in science, and we've had great faith in these institutions, political institutions,
right.
the nation state, and of course concepts like democracy and so on. But really, I mean, in individual lives, how useful are these? Are these concepts? Are these ideas?
Let's spend some time on that, because so the other thing that you point out is that we do tend to find we tend to look for satisfaction, or at least to measure our stability and success in terms of things we acquire, whether that be kind of success or material possessions, right? And we tend to look to politics and social structures and political changes if we're thinking about changing the human condition substantially. And what you point out is that really in the Buddha's most basic teachings is a completely different way of looking at the world and looking at life. And in fact, one that makes a lot of sense when individuals ponder their own lives. I'm sort of putting it in my words, but I want you to react and put it into yours.
Absolutely. I mean, I think one of the things that quickly, for me, distinguished the Buddha from a whole lot of very important Western thinkers, and in particular, you know, I'm thinking of Marx, and I'm thinking also of Adam Smith. I mean, those are sort of two most influential, I think, thinkers of the last 200, 300 years. And in many ways, their ideas have kind of shaped the modern world, the world we live in. I think the Buddha differs so radically from both of them in proposing an idea of change that has nothing at all to do with large-scale restructuring mm-hmm. of a political system or an economic system. He's not saying, he'll never say that, that you have to sort of reform a whole society in order to achieve happiness, that you have to, you know, create some kind of a perfect system or create institutions in order to ensure happiness for most of the members of that particular society. He's saying, he's sort of putting, you know, the sort of whole, posing a kind of challenge to individuals. He says, what can you do about it yourself in your own life? And how can you arrive at contentment or happiness, and also thereby create conditions for happiness of other people around you? The pursuit of these utopias in the last sort of 200, 300 years, and they've been pursued most, I think, fanatically in the last 200 years than at any other time, whether, you know, it's a sort of Nazi utopia of the Thousand-Year Reich, which was the most sort of disreputable of them all, but also the communist utopia. Mm-hmm. And now, of course, you see the pursuit of another kind of utopia, which is, you know, creating democracy and freedom around the world. These utopias, certainly, I think in Europe, you sense you have a great sense of disillusionment and exhaustion with these political utopias, because they've all sort of worked out so disastrously, and they've created such suffering and such violence. I mean, why is the 20th century the most violent century in history? Why has modernity proved to be so destructive? Why have these wonderful things, which we thought were going to guarantee us happiness, everlasting happiness, have not worked out? And why have they ended so badly? And I think asking those questions really lead you to examining these ideas on which a whole lot of these political systems have been created, the idea of individual happiness through consumption, through desire, and a kind of individual desire which in the end really does not respect any limits. It can go to any lengths to fulfill itself. So the whole idea of a sort of society just consisting of individuals who are, you know, fulfilling their desires and feeling new desires all the time, it is actually in the end a recipe for war and violence, because you are going to need,
and even just plain old unhappiness.
Plain old unhappiness, exactly, because you know, you, once again, the whole idea of the person who's desiring something yesterday is not the same person today. When he gets the thing he desires, he'll already have moved on, so he'll be unhappy again.
Yeah, you throw in this quote from Oscar Wilde, which is so wonderfully resonant with the Buddha as you juxtapose them. Oscar Wilde, who said, "In this world, there are only two tragedies, one of not getting what one wants and the other of getting it."
Isn't it wonderful?
Yes. And so here are some lines, you know, from your book in terms of, again, what the Buddha said that was different, that in fact, he was analyzing how we experience reality rather than describing what reality is, and saying that to control the mind was to change radically one's relation with the world. That you could create a whole mental climate through awareness, and that in fact is the only way. In fact, being in charge of of our own minds as a window to reality is the only way that in fact human beings can have, in a sense, some kind of sovereignty or real satisfaction.
Yeah, I want to give you an example. I mean, this may seem very far away, but because you know, things like torture and unhappiness of that kind has been so close to our minds, and you know, it's been in the news and all that. I've been thinking a great deal about these Tibetan victims of you know, torture in the last 30, 35 years, and there have been remarkable studies done of these victims and how they've managed to survive that experience, which is the most extreme instance, of course, of, you know, great pain being inflicted upon flesh, actual human flesh. And people somehow training their minds to experience it in a certain way so that they come out of it without the kind of deep psychological disorders that a lot of people who experience torture have suffered, who come out of it feeling compassion for the people who tortured them so mercilessly, feeling no sort of hatred, no remorse. And that, to me, I mean, you know, some people might say, well, they should really be angry out there, and anger would lead then to creative political action. But I think there is something remarkable about how these people have managed to survive this and yet still be opposed to violence and injustice and yet be allied to a political cause. And that, you know, is an illustration to me, a very vivid one, of how, you know, you can train your mind to experience things in a certain way, and you don't actually have to surrender to these emotions of anger and hatred and malice and vindictiveness.
And that is such a counterintuitive image that I think it's almost hard for a Western mind to even hoist in, even make sense of, or know what to do with, right?
It is. I think the once again, there are, you know, very important cultural differences here in the sense of Western sense of the ego, the Western sense of individuality is so much highly evolved and so much sort of valuable to people here. I mean, the sense of the self, the sense of being an individual, the sense, this whole idea of self-expression, all of these are such important things in this culture. So when you grow up in that particular tradition, you have this, you know, great sense of your being completely unique, individual, and all of that. And that sense of human dignity, when it comes under assault, I think it really undermines some very, very deeply held suppositions about yourself, who you are. So people whose identities are more fluid, which are not so fixed, and who, you know, are extremely skeptical about this whole sort of notion of the self or the notion of the ego, and can see the ego as a kind of constructed entity, an entity held together primarily by desire, I think perhaps those people are better able to deal with these experiences.
And do you feel that's also a difference between, I don't know, what we might call a Western and an Eastern mindset? I mean, as someone who grew up in India, do you feel that you did inherit a more fluid sense of identity in your culture?
I think I did. I mean, to grow up in a place like India was really to actually grow up with a whole set of overlapping identities. I mean, there's no one identity that you have. You know, you are, you know, you're a son and you're a brother and you're a student and you are, you know, Hindu at home and you go to a Christian school, so you're something else out there. You at home sort of you practice these very ancient, or your parents, you see your parents practicing these very ancient rituals and doing these, you know, performing these very, very, very old rites. And you are at the same time working on computers.
Reading
so
Nietzsche.
You live in all these many, many different worlds. Yeah. And, you know, there's no way you can actually have a solid, stable identity. I mean, I think it's futile to even attempt to have one. And in a way, kind of naturally acquire these or live with these, you know, different worlds and with these different identities.
I would like to, you talk in your book about how, as you got into all of this, the Buddha in the world and these ideas, you felt that on the one hand, Western culture, including this idea of the ego and Western definitions of success, had defined success for you in some sense, or at least that was maybe a part of those conflicting and overlapping ideas that were presented to you. But that as you got into these ideas yourself, you found that even some of the great icons of the Western way of being in the world, like Adam Smith, who you mentioned a minute ago, had real doubts and even expressed reservations about the shadow side of Western culture and Western progress that really echoed some of the Buddha's insights. And I just want to read this passage. I found it very striking. You quote Adam Smith saying that there's kind of a deception which keeps in continual motion the industry of mankind. After all, it is this which first prompted them to cultivate the ground. Oh, sorry. Let me start earlier. But I'm going to read this whole passage. But even Adam Smith, the proponent of free trade, had wondered early in his life if power and wealth, those great objects of human desire, can make one immune to anxiety, fear, sorrow, diseases, danger, and death. He had considered the idea that happiness could be secured through desiring more things than one needs a deception, and had eventually concluded that it is well that nature imposes on us in this manner. It is this deception which rouses and keeps in continual motion the industry of mankind.
Well, he was certainly a man who did not, you know, like being bored for a very long time. He just wanted to keep working, or wanted others to keep working and being industrious. And I think the whole idea of unproductive time and the idea of that you can, you know, spend your time doing other things than actually working or producing, it's still, I find that, a very alien notion here. I mean, most people, even when they have free time, they want to be doing something or other, you know, taking in a bit of culture.
You mean
so
this
on.
Country?
In the West on the whole.
Yeah.
Ian Forster has this wonderful passage in his novel, A Passage to India, about the sort of arts of leisure, that the sort of modern West will never learn. And he talks about this sort of wonderful festival he goes to, and there are sort of singers there and people lounging around on sofas and in this very relaxed pose. And it's a beautiful passage about the sort of old art of leisure in these sort of older traditions. But anyway, that's getting off on a different tangent altogether. Sorry, what was the question?
I'm curious. I think that you were somewhat stunned and in a sense felt that you had been deceived growing up in a culture which was given this Western way of acquisition and industry as the measure of success to which your country was also supposed to aspire. And then finding even in these leading minds of the way we became, finding some of the same, in some ways, the same kind of analysis of the human condition that the Buddha made, but settling with a deception.
Yeah. Well, I think it's sort of odd. I mean, I've begun to think of both India and, or this may sound very odd, but also America as living, at least in the last century, in a particular state of historical innocence, in that this whole European experience of the 19th century of, unlimited progress, unlimited expansion, great economic dynamism, which is really the model that, you know, a magazine like, say, The Economist promotes when it talks about, you know, what the IMF or the World Bank should be doing in the third world and what India should be doing or what China should be doing. And this is how, you know, we create happiness and how we create sort of wonderfully productive societies with very high GDP and so on. So these are ideas that we are now living with. But what happened in Europe in the early 20th century is kind of sort of an experience that whose lessons people in India did not learn. And I think in a strange way, even America was denied the lessons of that experience, because America at that time experienced this extraordinary growth in the early 20th century.
Well, describe what you're saying, what we didn't learn.
Well, the First World War, which now seems to sort of is extraordinary moment in European history, when suddenly, you know, you have this endless slaughter in over 4 years. And there's a whole generation that's wiped out. And all the leading thinkers and writers and artists of Europe sort of now start thinking, why did this happen? Where did all this belief and progress and technology and science take us to this horrible, destructive war? And so you have, you know, modernism, artistic modernism emerges out of this whole sort of experience, this terrible experience. And any European country one can think of, there are people out there, whether it's T.S. Eliot, whether there is, you know, Joyce, there is sort of Paul Valéry in France, Robert Musil, Thomas Mann. They're all thinking about, you know, what is going on, what has happened, why has this happened in Europe when we taught ourselves to be leading this, you know, wonderful march towards this glorious future, and we were right up there in the avant-garde of humanity's march. And suddenly we've sort of plunged into this completely senseless war. And I think it's such a crucial event that the First World War, and this whole lot of reflections upon the nature of society, the nature of the changes of the last 100, 150 years, Industrial Revolution, all of these things, people are thinking about it and, you know, arriving at a very skeptical notion of these utopias, the idea of progress, the idea of history being this great narrative of progress.
Right.
And somehow all of this was completely lost on, sort of writers or intellectuals or thinkers in India who were still working with 19th century notions of progress, who were thinking, well, if only we can duplicate what Europe did for itself in the 19th century, we'll be on our way. And America, because, you know, of the limited involvement in these wars of Europe, they also came out of this whole thing relatively innocent. And of course, I think Vietnam was perhaps the big shock. And I don't think India has really received that great shock yet. But I think it will. I mean, because it's sort of, it's really the trajectory is the same, this aspirations for great power status, this sort of, you know, longing for power, longing for prosperity. And it's not going to end well.
But, you know, one of the things that that you do in your book is you look at history, again, in the largest possible sense. And this seems to be a story that repeats itself in different ways. I mean, you compare, for example, Alexander, whose legacy was really one of violence, of conquest and violence, to the Indian, and that was in the, I believe, the 3rd century BCE, and then you compare him to the Indian ruler Ashoka, who converted to Buddhism and had a very different kind of legacy, and yet his has been obscured by history, and Alexander is someone who's just gotten a new blockbuster Hollywood movie done about him in the year 2005, right?
Absolutely. Yeah. I think, I mean, the sort of whole, this admiration for powerful people and admiration for people who supposedly make history or create history, this has really become a very dominant theme in this culture in the last sort of, 150, 200 years. And of course, we have to remember that history as a discipline, history as a sort of, well formed, with its own boundaries, with its own sort of laws, is also a very recent development.
Mm-hmm.
Really, emerges in the last 200 years. I mean, previously people thought of history as a mere record of, events that are worth remembering or commemorating. But now history becomes this sort of arena of human action where you can actually change history, where you can actually make history. And so people looking back at Alexander, I mean, the whole cult of Alexander really, I mean, it survived over the centuries, but it receives its apotheosis in the late 18th, 19th century.
Okay.
With Napoleon, who loved Alexander and wanted to, of course, imitate him. And Hitler loved Alexander and wanted to do what Alexander had done. So with the sort of arrival of modernity and the arrival of this notion of man making history, you start loving all these
and resurrecting selectively. Okay. Okay.
Yeah, selectively.
Yeah.
And of course, someone like Ashoka becomes utterly irrelevant.
Tell the story of Ashoka briefly for people who haven't heard of him.
He was an Indian emperor. He was, he held down this great empire, which came into being shortly after the Buddha's death. And people before him, he was a very brutal man. He great believer in conquest and expansion, and he conquered this eastern Indian state of Kalinga. And after this conquest, which was very extremely successful, but also very, very violent, he saw the enormous damage he had caused and deaths of thousands and thousands of people. And he was suddenly struck by this great remorse and, what he had done. And from that point, he kind of gave up violent conquest and violent wars, and became gradually to, came sort of gradually to introduce Buddhist ideas into statecraft. I mean, I don't think he actually embraced Buddhism or became a Buddhist. Once again, the idea of converting to Buddhism is a bit odd.
Mm-hmm.
What he did was he made nonviolence a kind of state policy whenever it was possible, whenever it was viable. Of course, he still had punishments for criminals he still had an army, but he tried as much as possible to combine Buddhist ideas of social welfare, compassion, and to be, as a ruler, the model of righteousness. I mean, the whole Buddhist emphasis, insofar as Buddhism engages with politics, it's very, keen on this idea that the ruler should be absolutely above board and should embody an idea of an ideal of righteousness. And Ashoka tried to do that by making himself accessible, by making himself and his ideas and the working of his thoughts completely transparent. For instance, in the inscriptions that he had inscribed on stone and iron pillars and erected all across India, he would say things like, it's very difficult to do good, because good and evil are unmixed things, and you have to worry about the consequences of doing good. All of these very complex ideas that he's thinking, which he shared with his subjects. Of course, now he would be accused of flip-flopping, not having clear ideas or having a decisive personality. Mm-hmm. But the very fact that he could see how the world was such a complex place and there wasn't, you know, such a clear-cut good and evil out there. That's, I find, something quite admirable about him.
The way you just talked about him also reminds me very much of Reinhold Niebuhr and his analysis of human nature and society.
Absolutely.
All right. So I think the problem is that, and maybe I'd be curious about how you have been discussing this book with being an American now, because I think an American, a modern American, might look at this history you tell and might still compare someone like Alexander and Ashoka or 21st century America and India and say it's clear which version of reality, which ethos is on the winning side, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, how do you know, they would say simply this ethos of acquisition and building and progress and power is what in fact works in this world we inhabit. How would you respond to that?
Well, I would very, quickly challenge the notion that it works. Where is the evidence that it works? I mean, what we do see is the sort of enormous costs of sticking to this ideal of acquisition, endless acquisition, endless expansion, endless preemption. I think what we are seeing now is a sort of real crisis. And of course, one can obscure the crisis by talking about completely different things altogether, talking about terrorism or talking about, you know, various sort of threats still to materialize in the future and so on. But the fact that this model is not working, the model has clearly proved to be inadequate. It's already created the most violent century and is all set to, you know, create or to lead us into an even more violent century. I mean, the 21st century has not started off very well.
Mm-hmm.
So in what way is this model working? I mean, I really do not see any evidence for that. What I do see is a whole lot of confusion, a whole lot of bewilderment, a whole lot of hatred, a whole lot of violence out there. And, you know, even people, even societies that are supposedly doing extremely well, such as China or India.
Yeah.
When you actually start thinking about 20, 30 years down the line, down in the future, you wonder about their big populations. You wonder about their great needs. What will these societies need once they come into their own as middle class consumers of the kind people in America are, the kind of this amount of oil they would need, the amount of energy resources they will have to find to sustain their populations at the standard of living they will have arrived at that point, if they do arrive at that standard of living. And where is that oil going to come from? You know, where is all the resources that we need to sustain these lifestyles, to sustain this model of development and progress going to come from? I think it's unsustainable, and that's why we are heading towards, and we already have, we already live in such violent times. So I'm completely unpersuaded by the notion that the systems we have are working. They're not. They failed a long time back. We just sort of, you know, because of this sort of, you know, power that can be manifested with bombs or that can be manifested with in standing armies and all kinds of other things. That power, the fact of power, obscures the failures. But the fact that you have to use violence all the time, you know, really points to the failure of these systems in many ways.
You traveled through India, or you tell about traveling through India at the same time that you were working on the book on Buddha, on other projects. And I wonder if you would tell some of the stories that are in there. I don't know if you want to focus on Kashmir as kind of a paradigm, as the contradictions and tragedies, or you know, the Bihar. You talk about the violence there, but just I don't think Americans hear those kinds of stories as also what is happening in the modern world and what is happening in a place like India, which, as you say, is often cited as a great example of an emerging democracy?
I think that's a very interesting question because, I mean, I think, I hope I made clear in the book how, you know, what may seem like completely unrelated journeys, like going to Kashmir to, you know, find out about the political situation there, to find out about human rights violations there, to find out why, you know, 50,000 people have died in the last 10 years there, can be in any way related to a book about the Buddha or an exploration of the Buddha's teachings. But the fact that, you know, it's these journeys really which made me think again, or it made me think again about what the Buddha has to tell us today, and also made me think maybe, you know, in sort of more sort of analytical ways about these assumptions that I myself as a journalist had going into these places. Like when you go into a place like Kashmir, you go into a place like Afghanistan, what you are really assuming is that what this place needs is a bit of democracy, a bit of a, you know, nation building of the kind we've already accomplished back in the West or in a place like India, and everything will be fine. But what we don't really understand is how these societies have lived, not just survived, but lived, even flourished for centuries and centuries, and how they have arrived at their own particular forms of wisdom, their own particular forms of, you know, being together with many, many ethnic components, with many, many, you know, in the case of Kashmir, several religions coming together, several religions living together.
And you described, the first time you went there, that it was this incredibly peaceful place also.
It was, and it has been, I mean, remarkably peaceful for many centuries.
Yeah.
I mean, the Islam that came to Kashmir was a sort of Sufi inflected Islam. It was never a fundamentalist Islam. And of course, fundamentalist Islam is also a very, very modern phenomenon, so Kashmir wouldn't have experienced that anyway.
Yeah.
But they've had this extremely tolerant variety of Islam there, which coexisted with the pre-existing Hindu and Buddhist traditions there for many centuries. And once again, you have to ask yourself the question, and I mean, it's raising these questions which is important. Why is it that Kashmir has become such a violent place in the last 50, 60 years? Why has this tradition, which is known for its great sort of poetry and the beauty of its songs, the beauty of its architecture, why has it produced this horrible violence in the last 50 years? Mm-hmm. And only then, if you frame the question correctly, would you be able to see how, you know, this whole idea that we are going to modernize Kashmir, we are going to make Kashmir part of this new democratic nation state of India. And of course, there's no time for religion because we are all going to be secular citizens, secular consumers of the new modern nation state of India. And there is no scope for any other visions in this particular model we've got there. And so what you have is sort of people coming in and telling the Kashmiris that they have to now be loyal to this Republic of India, which most of them had never been to, most of them don't know anything about. But they have to be loyal to it because India, you know, of course, is this wonderful centralized state, and it's now going to be a superpower in the next 30, 40 years, and they better be part of it, otherwise they'll be left out of the march of history. So this great sort of this society which has lived in this relative peace for all these years is given these new ideas of, you know, democracy, of being equal citizens, and all this fed all this rhetoric. And of course, the rhetoric always lags behind reality. The reality is that, you know, it's this, a lot of this is just basically the rhetoric of the ruling elite that wants to create a basis for its own legitimacy. So they are the ones who are saying, well, we are going to lead you into this new world, and we are the experts, we are the elite. And some people, of course, get promoted up into this elite, but a majority of the Kashmiris remain, you know, and sometimes the conditions even worsens. I mean, they had a functioning economy, they had a sort of, you know, functioning society, and suddenly it's broken into by these foreign elements. And what do the Kashmiris do after several years? They take up arms, and they are, of course, supported by these radical Islamists in Pakistan and in Afghanistan, who are also, in a way, suffering from the sort of same phenomena. It's like, you know, the communists coming into Afghanistan and saying, we're going to modernize the whole place overnight. It's not, you know, we're not even going to wait for too long. We're just going to do it. And going into villages, forcing people to do this and to do that, and, you know, creating a kind of backlash. So before you have created enough economic prosperity, enough, you know, you've created the economic basis for modernization, you're sort of pushing through these ideas because those ideas have been, you know, verified by Marx, or these very ideas are the way the world is going. It's the danger of exporting these abstract models of modernity, abstract models of democracy and secularism to these sort of very, very old, very traditional societies that has created such incredible violence in the last, you know, 50, 60 years or so. And this is what we are seeing in these places.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, again, to circle back, I mean, how has your exploration of the Buddha and his life and teachings, how does that speak to you, to those questions that you've just posed?
Well, I think it sort of offered me a new way of looking at, you know, what human beings are here to do and the other ways in which human beings have formed and can form a society or live together, that societies or states do not have to be built upon, you know, these particular notions of the sort of these or do not have to conform to these particular models that we've had in the last 200, 250 years, that there can be other ways of being. I'm not saying that these sort of models of society are in any way, you know, imminent or any way we can realize that. But I think what's important now, because for a lot of people, and it's been particularly true of myself, it's very easy to, you know, just settle into despair because the way the world we've created for ourselves just seems like such a prison. There seems no way out. And it seems like this is the only way. Just keep pushing it forward as much as we can go and see what happens. And maybe it'll all work out. Maybe it'll all be fine in the end. But I think a whole lot of new thinking is needed. I mean, this is why people like Reinhold Niebuhr, so many of these thinkers are still so important, that they, people who sort of, you know, come out of this experience of Europe in the 20th century, who meditated on that experience, really knew that this was a serious crisis, that this was not going to be dealt with by invoking democracy every 2 seconds, or by just saying, you know, free enterprise is going to solve all the problems, or free trade is the answer, or globalization is the answer, that, you know, this is avoiding the problem. Really looking at new ways in which human beings can sort of relate to each other.
But the irony is that if you start invoking the Buddha at these particular problems, then, so we're talking now on kind of a macro scale, but the Buddha would point back to not individualism, but to the individual person's ability to control his experience of the world, his or her experience of the world, right? I mean, what would the Buddha say to Kashmiris who are caught in that tragedy?
Well, I think he would probably say something different to them in terms of what he would say to, compared to what he would say to their Indian overlords.
Okay.
I can see, I mean, it would be interesting to speculate how he would say respond to contemporary America, where he would see a whole lot of centralized state power, although, you know, big government, everyone is sort of suspicious of, and certainly the conservatives are suspicious, but the fact that big government exists and is growing bigger all the time in terms of the control it has and the helplessness individuals feel about not having control over their political destinies, of not having great say. I mean, this whole social security debate that's going on. And what he would argue for is sort of devolving power down so that people can create, you know, effective functioning democracies within their little communities, the places where they actually live, rather than looking up to these remote sort of congressmen, to these remote senators, and these bills that nobody even reads being passed in D.C. and in all this endless debate, and which no one can really follow, no one has the time to follow. I mean, the world, these democracies have become so complex, the decision-making has become so obscure that nobody really knows what's going on. I mean, nobody's participating anymore except, you know, once every 4 years when they turn out to vote. And even then, most people don't turn out to vote. And right. This is also a case of democracies elsewhere. So the argument for, you know, a different way of looking at this problem and really identifying what the problem is, also, you know, examining these notions of, for instance, I mean, one of the arguments I heard repeatedly after November elections was, you know, if only people knew their self-interest, they would have voted for Kerry. I find that a rather puzzling argument because a lot of people could see where their self-interest was, and they voted for George W. Bush. The self-interest still the motor of, you know, is still be held as this motor of modern society. And if so, that self-interest of Americans, does it not at some point collide with the self-interest of people elsewhere? I mean, I think we have to rethink these notions that sort of assume.
How can that be a primary value if that, in fact, is true?
Absolutely.
A moral value.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then, you know, you describe, you were in India when 9/11 happened, and you describe watching that and saying to yourself, having this moment of realization that the brutality of the world I had grown up in had now come to America. You make this really interesting observation, I think, which is really an observation about globalization, which in some ways 9/11 brought home to Americans, that there seemed to be no refuge now from a history that was now truly universal. That's a very big thought about the time in which we live. I mean, you talked earlier about how the Buddha grew up in this moment of the end of things and the beginning of something new, and that's certainly one way of talking about how the world we're living in is new.
Well, I was thinking, I mean, because so much of what has happened in the last 200 years really begins in Europe and begins in the West, and I think of America as a sort of, you know, part of the West. And then it's radiated out of Europe in terms of people going out and conquering and, you know, acquiring these new lands and these new territories all across the world in Asia and Africa, breaking into these very, very old societies and reshaping them, refashioning them. And all of these people, you know, thinking of themselves as making history, of making a new world. And then, you know, I think this sort of notion of history that we in India, people in India, had absolutely no clue to. I mean, the notion of history or something, or, you know, acting in time which just changes the world, these are completely alien ideas in the Hindu tradition or on the Buddhist tradition,
right,
where man is not given this kind of power, okay, you know, or in Islam for that instance. So these people are utterly bewildered by, you know, the sort of onslaught of Western ideas and Western technologies. And this is really what is globalization. I mean, globalization is not a process that begins in the last 10 years or 20 years or so. It's been going on for the last 150, 200 years. The mm-hmm. very fact that I sit here speaking in English, which is not my native language, not my first language, I'm sitting here, you know, wearing Western clothes, an Indian born in India, and, you know, have grown up with these sort of diverse traditions, both Indian and Western, just goes on to show how globalization is a much, much older event. Mm-hmm. And it has gone well in certain cases, and it's not gone so well in many other cases. And what we are seeing is a kind of response to this on the part of people who feel left out, who feel frustrated, who feel politically impotent, not able to control their destinies, utterly bewildered people, utterly confused people, resorting to violence, resorting to ideological violence of the kind we saw on 9/11. And I think, you know, these dispositions to ideological violence are kind of shared across the world. I mean, they're not particular to Al-Qaeda or to the BJP or the Hindu nationalists in India. They are, I mean, anyone is now capable of them because mm-hmm. this is, you know, this is now, this, the world that we live in is kind of, has been created by this sort of, you know, spread of ideas and technologies. And when these ideas spread, they become, or they, when they are imposed upon these societies, they become ideologies. And, you know, people then come up with counter ideologies. And this is what we're seeing in the case of radical Islam.
You know, let me, I'd like to read another passage from your book, which, well, I'll read this and then ask you something. Mm-hmm. You write, in his own time, the Buddha saw self-made men, new social and economic forces. He could sense the dangers in men freed from traditional morality and claiming to be self-directed individuals. It is partly why he questioned the very premise of the autonomous self-directed individual, that he is someone who chooses and pursues his own desires and thereby comes to possess his individuality, the hypothesis that lies even now in an age where mass manipulation is a respectable industry at the basis of modern civilization. This is moving away a little bit from what you were saying, but really at the root of this is Westerners who, you know, take history in their own hands, right, as individuals and then collectively. But I think, I wonder if, I think that maybe we're at this moment in history where, in this country, where people might be able to hear a critique like that and internalize it in a way they wouldn't 20, 30, 40 years ago. And I wonder if that's, if you share that sense.
Perhaps because the whole sort of ideological utopias that were pursued in Europe, I mean, they certainly, because they ended in so much suffering. In Europe, I think there is a great sense of exhaustion. And mm-hmm. one reason why Europe has been very reluctant to join in, apart from Great Britain, of course, with the United States in its recent sort of adventures abroad, because they, I think, have a shrewder sense of what it entails to, you know, go into these areas. They have this historical experience of colonialism behind them, and, you know, and particularly a country like France, which has been badly burned by right. Its sort of own colonial adventures. I think that realization, and, you know, when I read people in American writers in the late 60s or early 70s, I see it, it's extremely vivid. I mean, this whole sort of notion, and particularly I find that in the work of Hannah Arendt, who's constantly questioning this sort of notion of progress, this notion of history, this notion of making history. But there comes a time when, you know, there's very little writing of that sort. And I think, you know, in the late 70s, it begins to disappear and so on. And at some point, I'm sure there will be more, writers or thinkers here coming back to examining these notions. And of course, now you've got the neoconservatives here who have appropriated many of these notions of making history or sort of, you know, making the world safe for democracy and so on. I'm sure the critique that now emerges would be a very powerful one, which would encompass not just the particular actions of these neoconservatives, but also the larger, you know, ideology that is driving them. And I think is the responsibility, I mean, in one sense, of the left here. And I feel slightly ambivalent about this because the left has so much for so long believed in that ideology itself of endless progress.
Well,
and
then,
so on.
This idea, which really the Buddha is set over against the left or the right, to the extent that, and this is something that I think is very simple, but you make it very clear in the book that it's a different idea of approaching the problems. It is, as you say, offering a cure for human suffering that does not involve large-scale restructuring of state and society, that doesn't look at social change in the same way.
Yeah.
How do you move through the world, read differently, ponder these questions, these kinds of questions you've raised with me differently because of this book you've written about the Buddha in the world?
Well, it certainly really, I think, changed my way of looking at a lot of things, you know, quite radically, I think, in that I've perhaps just sort of become more skeptical of a lot of the assumptions I previously worked with when going to when reporting on, you know, say, sort of Kashmir or Afghanistan or Pakistan or just reporting on events in India or, you know, writing fiction and so on.
Mm-hmm.
It sort of made me, I suppose, more suspicious of abstractions and abstractions which kind of, you know, hold out some kind of contentment or bliss or happiness in some, you know, unknown, unknowable future, and saying, well, you have to sacrifice your present for the sake of that. And in the end, it will work out, even if the means we are using are not so great, but the ends would be fine. And I think it's made me more suspicious of ideas like these and made me more committed to, you know, being in the present, living in the present, and using ethically sound means in the present, being ethically responsible to the people around one right now, not in the future, but right now. And the future will then take care of itself if you're honest and if you're, you know, clear in your sort of moral thinking at this moment, and to not sort of, you know, let these abstract institutions carry the burden of the pain of people living now, but not say that, you know, 4 years down the line we might have democracy and it'll all be wonderful. No, I think that it will be too late. 4 years, even 4 days will be too late. I think we need to attend to what we have in front of us. And I think that really has been the most, I think personally for me, the most sort of important change in my perception of you know, the world I live in and move through.
What projects do you have coming up? What's your next? And I wonder if the way you think about what you want to write about or what you want to take on as a subject has changed through wrapping your arms around the Buddha in this way.
Well, I think sort of, I mean, I keep doing the same things in the sense that I keep sort of traveling and I keep going to places that I know little about and want to, you know more about and want to really go and talk to people. Like, I'm thinking of going to Nepal. It's a very small country and hardly ever features in the newspapers here or indeed anywhere else. But they've sort of experienced this rather, you know, traumatic last few years. And now they are in the midst of this extraordinary insurgency, which is led by people who call themselves Maoists. And that, to me, is a fascinating phenomenon. And, you know, they are extremely popular. They control 80% of the countryside. And, you know, communism, which is kind of ruled out and kind of dismissed as a sort of, has been almost 10, 12 years back, is making a comeback in a place where no one expected it to arise in the first place. And it's also making its presence felt, communist movements in large parts of northern India. And this is something I've become very interested in how these sort of people organize themselves into these movements. And these are people who are completely out of this new world of created by globalization, this sort of new elites that have been created in places like India and Nepal, who are extremely cruel and ruthless in the way they deal with the people out of, you know, the net of globalization in their countries. So there is a backlash to you know, a lot of this new small prosperous elites being created in these places. And I think this is part of it, part of the backlash, the rise of this sort of movement that we all thought had died a long time back. So I'm interested in that, and I'm interested, you know, in knowing more about it, simply because I don't think I'm being very well informed by the newspapers and magazines I read on about this.
Okay. I think we've covered lots of ground, and I want to see if there are any questions behind the glass. I'll be quiet for a moment and be listening.
Sure.
Right, right. Okay. Yeah. Okay. All right. So the question of whether this kind of Buddhist analysis of human nature, if this were embraced, or whether this is, you know, we touched on whether this is an unsuccessful, a losing proposition versus the powerful proposition that seems to make history. But another way to ask that question that might be more more realistic is, and I'm very interested in how you would answer this, is, you know, if this kind of Buddhist view of being in the world and understanding history should be embraced, would industry stop? Would progress as we know it stop, even in ways that you might define that as good?
Well, I think it'll embracing these ideas would involve such a radical re-examination of a whole lot of stuff we do unconsciously almost every day. I think it would be a good thing in that what we think of now of was progress were to stop, some of it at least.
Right.
Because it just simply creates, great deal of frustration and resentment and violence in the rest of the world. I think if we were to re-examine these sort of very basic ideas of what are we here to do and, you know, how does one find peace? How does one find inner happiness? And what does happiness consist of? I mean, these sound like very simple questions, but I think they are in the way the Buddhists pose them, they are very, very complex, and they sort of the implications just extend into every realm of human action. Of course, I mean, it's ludicrous to kind of imagine a world where people just sort of give up their day jobs and retreat into some kind of Buddhist utopia and so on. But I think what is happening here in America, and I find the Buddhist movement here very interesting for that reason, is that people have their day jobs and people are working and, you know, they have their professional careers and so on. At the same time, they're bringing Buddhist insights and Buddhist ideas more and more in harmony with what they do and the kind of jobs they do, the kind of, you know, careers they have. And I think this is one, you know, way of proceeding, one modest way of starting. And it's not to be mocked, it's not to be ridiculed, just because there are very obvious contradictions in all this. When people, you know, look at Bollywood film stars and think of, you know, they can't obviously be Buddhist, it's all a big show.
Right.
I think that's a very, very sort of, you know, unrewarding way to look at this phenomena, because, you know, these people who have known really very few other choices when you grow up in a culture which exalts success, which exalts ambition, and then you arrive at these, you know, places where everyone else wants to be, and then you realize that actually there is a lot of discontentment and unhappiness that you still feel, and then you're drawn to these, you know, Eastern traditions and philosophy. I find myself quite sympathetic to that particular plight and particular situation. And I find it's, you know, in very small, significant ways, this is the kind of Buddhism that will take hold here and will always be, I think, a small scale phenomena, but it will attract, I think, the brightest, the sort of the most interesting members of the elite here in America. And that is the way I see it making its way into the world, into the modern world.
Does it interest you also that there are many people in this country embracing Buddhist philosophies and techniques alongside the practice of other religions, of Christianity and Judaism, especially?
Yes. I mean, I suppose Buddhism is always been compatible with, you know, sort of other pre-existing traditions and religions. And that's why it's sort of taken a different form wherever it's traveled to, whether China or Japan or Korea. I mean, everywhere it's kind of interacted with these other religions and traditions that existed there. So it's not sort of, it does not, call upon the believer, as it were. It doesn't even have, you know, it doesn't even ask you to believe in anything. It just pretty much leaves your, you know, pre-existing religion or religious loyalties intact. It does not ask you to give them up or anything like that, simply because it's not engaging with questions of God, or if you want to believe in God, well, that's, you know, that's your business.
Mm-hmm.
You can believe in God, but the question of suffering still remains. So you have to deal with that.
Okay. Well, this is just tremendous. I'm so glad you could make
Thank
the time
you.
To do oh, this.
That was wonderful.
Is there anything you would want to say, add, or that I haven't asked you?
You seem to have asked me everything.
Well, quite everything, yeah. but I'm just so glad to have discovered the book, and we will let you know what's happening with the program.
Terrific.
Okay.
Thanks.
Thanks so much.
Bye-bye.
Bye.